May it please the court, I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the plaintiffs Colorado Pool Systems and Patrick Kitowski. I'd like to focus my argument today on the issue set forth in this court's order of April 5 regarding the various common law standards for coverage, as well as the application of Section 132808, also known as House Bill 1394. And I want to start with a statute for several reasons. First, I believe that the statutory presumption does in fact govern here. Second, I want to address conflicting authority regarding the statute's retroactivity, particularly in the Tenth Circuit's opinion in Greystone Construction and the decision from this court last week in TCD versus American Family. And third, even if the statutory presumption of coverage does not apply, or does not control, House Bill 1394 makes a number of important findings and expressions of Colorado policy that would be pertinent to any proper analysis of the common law. Now, as this court is aware, House Bill 1394 was enacted in response to the opinion by a panel of this court in General Security in February 2009. The issue in General Security was whether the claim alleged property damage caused by an occurrence, where occurrence was defined as an accident, and that was an undefined term. And General Security rejected the holding of this court 4 years earlier in Huang versus Montero Homes. In Huang, this court had held that it's the knowledge and intent of the insured that makes injuries and damages expected or intended rather than accidental. And in General Security, the court held that an accident is a fortuitous event, something that happens by chance. And poor workmanship isn't an accident unless there's also consequential damage inflicted upon a third party, because no consequential property damage was specifically alleged in that case. The court found no triggering occurrence or accident. Now, the legislature was quick to overturn the decision in General Security. On May 21st, 2010, House Bill 1394 was enacted. The legislature said, first, interpretation of insurance policies for construction professionals is of vital importance to the social and economic welfare of the citizens of Colorado. Second, construction professionals have a reasonable expectation that they'll be defended against these claims. Third, the long-standing and continuing policy of Colorado favors a broad interpretation of the insurer's duty to defend these claims. And fourth, the General Security decision does not properly consider a construction professional's reasonable expectations of being defended. So to clarify and confirm long-standing Colorado policy, the legislature set forth a number of presumptions, burdens of proof, rules of interpretation. In particular, it said that a court shall presume that the work of a construction professional that results in property damage, including damage to the work itself or other work, is an accident unless the property damage is intended and expected by the insured. Now, Scottsdale argues that House Bill 1394 was not intended to have retroactive effect, because it says that it applies to all policies currently in existence or issued on or after the effective date of this act. Scottsdale says the phrase currently in existence limits application to policies that have so-called policy periods that include the enactment date. So if the policy covers only occurrences that took place before the enactment date, the statute doesn't apply. And Scottsdale's position is admittedly supported by Greystone and the decision last week in TCD. They both state unequivocally that Section 132808 has no retroactive effect. But I respectfully suggest that if there's one thing that we should be able to agree upon, is that the statute clearly has some retroactive effect. A statute is retroactive if it operates on transactions that have already occurred, or on rights and obligations that existed before its effective date. It's undisputed that Section 132808 applies to at least some insurance policies that were entered into before the date of enactment. In fact, the statute itself says it applies to interpretation of policies that, quote, have been issued, as well as those that, quote, may be issued. And it's also undisputed the statute applies to at least some accidents and occurrences that took place before the effective date. In fact, the statute expressly applies to actions, that is, lawsuits that were pending, as well as future actions interpreting liability policies. So the statute clearly has a very substantial retroactive effect. And the real question is whether the legislature intended to carve out from that retroactive effect a group of insurance policies that had already been issued but did not happen to cover accidents taking place on the date of enactment. Now, Scottsdale says all policies currently in existence affirmatively excludes all policies with policy periods that ended before the enactment date. The idea is apparently that these policies simply ceased to exist, but that's contrary to well-established law that an occurrence policy does not expire, that does not cease to exist, but rather continues in effect after the policy period ends. The legislature is presumed to be aware of that law when it enacts the statute.
Is there anything in the legislative history that expressly speaks to the meaning of policies currently in existence with regard to facts such as those before us where the policy period in an occurrence policy has expired?
I'm not aware of anything in the legislative history, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Can you tell me, under your view of the statutory text, what is the purpose of the phrase policies currently in existence?
I think when the legislature said the statute, quote, applies to all policies currently in existence or issued on or after the effective date of this act, it wasn't limiting application of the statute. It was simply saying that the statute applies to all policies that are already in existence, as well as those that may later come into existence. And that makes sense. No one has articulated any rational basis between distinguishing between policies that happen to cover accidents on May 21st, 2010, and those that don't. The legislature said it was clarifying and confirming Colorado's long-standing and continuing policy. When legislation is intended to clarify rather than change law, it's presumed to have retroactive effect. And it wouldn't make sense for the legislature to say that for those policies that do not happen to cover accidents occurring on the date of enactment, the erroneous decision in General Security applies, that we should not apply the long-standing and continuous policy of Colorado.
Doesn't the statute do more than merely overrule General Security? I mean, it seems to me in enacting the various procedures and the burdens of proof and the presumptions, it does more than simply correct what you believe is General Security's misapprehension of the meaning of accident, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't it be rational for the legislature to say, as indeed we must agree, I think, that the statute applies retroactively to some degree, but not this far back? We're going to take it back to policies that are for which the policy period has not expired, but we're not going to upset the apple cart for those policies in which the policy period has expired. Why isn't that a rational thing to do?
Well, it's not rational because, first of all, it doesn't distinguish between policies that may have been negotiated and entered into prior to the date of enactment and those that are negotiated and entered into after. And it also doesn't distinguish between occurrences that take place before the date of enactment and occurrences that take place after the date of enactment. Distinguishing between policies that simply happen to be in effect on this particular date, in effect, I'm sorry, I want to be clear about that, that their policy period is on that date. It's difficult to make any rational basis for that distinction.
You're saying, here's a question that I have, and I confess up front that I'm going to have a hard time asking it, so please bear with me.
Okay.
I'm aware of this presumption that statutes apply prospectively only, and to overcome that presumption, courts require significant textual evidence of an intent to apply it retroactively. And your argument is that whatever policy's currently existence means, under whatever definition, that clearly indicates some intent to apply it retroactively.
That's correct.
Now we have this question then about how far back. You know, what, now that we're clearly going to apply it retroactively to some degree, so the presumption is overcome, what sort of test or evidence do we need for determining such questions as about how far back the statute reaches, or to which cases or which policies it reaches? And I posit two metaphors. One is that we've overcome the presumption and we're past the line and it's just open field running. Any textual evidence we... The other metaphor has to do sort of with gravity. You know, that to the we favor a prospective application, and that the farther we go back, we need clearer and clearer evidence of an intent. In other words, we would need a heightened sense of going further back. Does that make sense?
I understand that the...
I apologize for the inartful way.
Right, yes, sir.
What is your view?
First of all, I'm glad that the court made the point that we have, in fact, overcome that presumption of pure prospectivity. So we are in the, as you say, the open field, and we're simply looking at what the statute means without any presumption acting as a headwind. I don't think that we have to have a heightened burden looking further and further back. I think, for example, to take a comparison here, if under Scottsdale's reading and Franklin Greystone's reading, we could have a policy that is entered into, say, for a period of 3 months, a policy period of 3 months, is entered into 6 months before the date of enactment, and an occurrence takes place within that three-month period. Well, even though it's only 3 months before the date of enactment, under the Scottsdale's interpretation, there would be no coverage, or at least the presumption, rather, would not apply. But if we had a policy period that goes, say, 5 years from 2005 to 2010, an occurrence takes place in 2006, it would have coverage. And that doesn't make sense. And it's not because I think we simply have to look at the statutory language and the intent. And again, the legislature made it very clear that we are confirming long-standing and continuing Colorado policy. It's a Colorado policy that was in place at least as far back as 2005 in this court's opinion in Huang versus Montero Homes.
But is that correct? I mean, is there any common law case that would define coverage as broadly as the statute does?
I think Huang versus Montero Homes says, well, accident means neither expected nor intended. Now, the statute does go further. It says you have to show that it was both expected and intended. To that extent, I'm not sure that there's anything that goes that far.
Okay.
And the same with Hecla. The same with we cited State Farm versus McMillan. So to that, I think, relatively small extent in the scheme of things, it goes somewhat further.
Really, it seems to me that the extent to which it changes common law really is tied up with which of these cases we view as the best statement of the existing common law, you know, at the time of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I hope you'll at some point get to this question, because it seems to me that the statute doesn't just change the nature of coverage, at least as applied here, but as applied here, it would operate sort of retroactively, or could operate retroactively, to make unreasonable coverage decisions that an insurance company engages in before the enactment of the statute. In other words, the insurance company could, relying on the common law, look at the statute and say, I'm sorry, you're not covered, we're not going to provide a defense. The statute comes along, and now it retroactively sort of changes the reasonableness of the insurance company's conduct.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that gets into the question of unconstitutionality, of retrospectivity. Assuming that the legislature did intend retroactive application, the statute must be applied unless operation would be unconstitutionally retrospective. Scottsdale says retroactive application here would create these new obligations that it didn't agree to when it entered into this contract back in April 2005. Again, first, it is the legislature's position that the law simply clarifies and confirms the existing law. But even if it created new obligations, it wouldn't be unconstitutionally retrospective in light of public interest, statutory objectives, and the highly regulated nature of the insurance industry. The statute advances public interest in accurately interpreting insurance policies and conforming to what the legislature regarded, and I dare say made a factual finding of what their reasonable expectations are. And Scottsdale cannot, in this case, credibly argue that when it entered into a policy with Colorado Pool just 2 months after this court issued its ruling in Huang versus Montero Homes, that it was somehow relying on a contrary opinion that would come out 4 years later. So the statute applies, and with no showing that property damage was both intended and expected, the trial court erred in failing to presume that the alleged substandard workmanship was an accident and an occurrence that triggered coverage.
Before you move off the statute, what is your position on whether the phrase policies currently in existence is ambiguous as applied to these facts?
I don't believe that it is ambiguous. And again, in part that's because of what we cited as the existing law regarding the nature of an insurance, of an occurrence policy. But I also do want to make clear, even if it's ambiguous, we do not have this presumption of pure prospectivity that we have to sort of get around. In other words, if it were to be found ambiguous, we would not therefore have to find that it has to be construed against us, and I want to make that clear.
Counsel, on this idea that there would be no constitutional impediment to retroactive application here because this is a highly regulated industry, can you give me what is the best authority that will support and educate me about the contours of that?
I believe the state of DeWitt discusses that, and of course the Larimer County opinion that came out on November 1st of 2011, same day as Greystone, I believe, also discussed that a bit. I can't say that I have a lot to say about that, except that insurance companies expect to be regulated. They're highly regulated. They're told what they have to provide coverage for, they're told of consequences if they don't do that.
I'm interested that this statute, in a way, doesn't really purport to regulate insurance companies as much as courts. It seems to tell us, here's how you're going to read these private contracts. You know, and that's an unusual thing. When do we see these kinds of statutes?
I think a very good example would be in the Uniform Commercial Code, where the Uniform Commercial Code actually tells us when you have, the term FOB or something like that, in a private contract of sale, this is what it means. And I think sort of a fortiori, the legislature should be able to do that in the insurance context. If the court has no more questions on the retroactivity of the statute, I'd like to go on and consider the common law standards. Because I think there's still the coverage, even under the common law standards. As the court stated in its order of April 5, there are several standards that have been articulated. In Huang versus Montero Homes, the court held, broadly, there is an occurrence and an accident triggering coverage when poor workmanship causes damage that is neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insured. General Security, more narrow. Workmanship standing alone doesn't ordinarily trigger coverage, but if there's consequential property damage inflicted on a third party, then there is coverage. And Greystone, the panel found coverage where poor workmanship causes damage to any non-defective property, whether it's the insured's own property or a third party's property. Now, we believe the standard of Huang versus Montero Homes is consistent with this court, with the Supreme Court's opinion in Hecla, McMillan, State Farm versus McMillan, Cypress Amex Minerals, which defined property damage very broadly to include things like costs to repair property. Huang is also more consistent with the legislature's expression of public policy, favoring coverage and finding that construction professionals have a reasonable expectation of coverage.
Don't we only get to the insured's reasonable expectations test if the policy language is ambiguous?
Not under the statute, Your Honor. I don't.
No, but I mean, I'm not trying to take away your statutory right. argument. We're just talking common law.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, generally, if the language is considered unambiguous, then there's no further need to look into what someone might consider to be the reasonable expectations of the parties. I will point out that in Hecla Mining and in State Farm versus McMillan, the court held that the term accident is in fact ambiguous and therefore construed the term in favor of the insured.
That's your position? The operative language is ambiguous.
I guess my position is that it unambiguously applies to unintended or unexpected. But if it is ambiguous, and the Supreme Court has found the term is ambiguous, then it must be construed in favor of coverage.
Seems to me that the courts are kind of all over the map here about the meaning of this term. Is that some evidence of ambiguity, or do we sort of base our determination of ambiguity on the sort of case-by-case text-specific? I mean, can we properly contemplate the various views as evidence of ambiguity?
Well, I think, again, I mean, the Colorado Supreme Court, I'll acknowledge it found that there was ambiguity, but then staked out a position on that. I will say that, as I think the court in Greystone recognized, and as was recognized, we cited a law review article in our supplemental authority last week. What is described in Greystone, I think, as the strong modern trend, holds that defective construction is an occurrence triggering coverage as long as the damage is neither expected nor intended by the insured. I do want to stress again that coverage is available, I believe, under any of these standards. The allegedly poor workmanship here was a subcontractor's positioning or repositioning of rebar in one wall of a pool. Mr. Hagen of White Construction stated that as a result of that negligent work, the entire pool was damaged. Surrounding work by other contractors was damaged. Electrical conduit would be damaged. Nearby retaining walls, sidewalks, decks might also be damaged. These are allegations of property damage under the policy.
So let me ask you about that, and this is going to be kind of a kindergarten question, I'm afraid. Property damage is defined physical injury to tangible property. So my question is, what is the damage here? I mean, there's no question that if this pool had cracked and leaked onto adjacent property and it damaged the property, or if it cracked and someone had tripped and been injured, there would be physical injury of some sort, not property damage. But here, why isn't this pool just defective? It's not damaged in the sense that, you know, there's been some, I don't know, injury to it. It's just bad work.
I'd like to point out that the definition of property damage is actually considerably broader than that. It's physical injury and loss of use of property that is not physically injured. And here we have, and one can argue whether this is established as a matter of law, but we certainly have allegations that the entire pool, not just this one portion, was, as I understand it, physically damaged, but also that there was loss of use, and again, under a broad reading, certainly, of the allegations, that there was a loss of use of electrical conduit, sidewalks, decks, and so on.
All of which is going to be sort of expected and intended in the sense that when the contractor comes out and looks at the pool and says, yeah, this pool's messed up and we're going to have to rip it up, and when we do, we're going to have to take out the retaining wall and the conduit and that kind of stuff. Why isn't that, in a way, expected and intended? Because they're all sort of saying, this is what's going to have to happen, and we're going to do this when we take it up.
Well, I think it's just a consequence of an unexpected, unintended accident. The fact that we can see this tidal wave of injury coming, I don't think is precludes us from finding that it's still property damage.
Let me recast Judge Russell's question a little bit differently, and I'm not asking you to concede any other parts of your argument. Let's assume that we adopt Greystone, which seems to draw a bright line distinction between repairing defective work is by definition foreseeable, but the consequences of the to the contractor's non-defective work probably isn't foreseeable. Do you accept that distinction under Greystone? I mean, do you see that distinction in Greystone?
I understand.
Okay, that. Except was a poor choice of words on my part. Yes. Okay. Here, is there a factual dispute as to whether the pool, on the one hand, is essentially an integrated product, and if some of it's defective, it's all defective? Or is there a factual dispute that part of the pool is non-defective and the part, I guess, most proximate to the rebar is defective? Well, for purposes of the Greystone distinction.
And I would say for purposes of summary judgment, there's at the very least a factual dispute on that. And let's keep in mind, of course, that we're also dealing with the duty to defend as well as the duty to indemnify. Exactly what the allegations were that were being brought, and it's not necessarily the same as the facts that eventually would be established about what property damage there was and what loss of use there was.
What would we look to determine what the allegations were?
Well, Scottsdale did not put into the record, in support of its motion for summary judgment, a copy of the arbitration complaint brought by White. And I think that's a significant failing in finding that there's no duty to defend these claims. We don't even know, at least on the record, what the precise allegations were. I just have a bit over 1 minute. I'd like to reserve that time, if I may. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Joel Palmer, and I am here on behalf of Scottsdale Insurance Company. I will be taking 20 minutes, and the other appellee's counsel will be taking 10. Although there are several issues in this matter regarding the idea of collateral estoppel, alleged representations and covers that were made, I will not be addressing those because I think the other appellee's counsel's commentary on these matters will sufficiently address those. I'll try to take the issues for the sake of clarity in the order that appellant's counsel took them. And the first being this idea of retroactivity. And I think there's some commentary here about, is there some sort of initial threshold of retroactivity that's already been overcome? In other words, to some extent, is it retroactive? We just can't figure out the parameters or the scope of that. I would reject that assertion. The legislature is presumed to know the appellate court decisions on retroactivity. They're presumed to know the history of cases from this court and from the Colorado Supreme Court that state that if a statute is to be retroactive, it is to be made explicitly clear, unambiguously clear, within that statute that it will have retroactive effect. And yet, in this statute, when it was enacted, it uses language that we might call ambiguous, although I don't think it is ambiguous, to say that it applies to policies that are currently in existence.
So do you address first this concept of this language, for the purposes of guiding pending and future actions? How can this statute guide pending actions unless it necessarily applies retroactively?
There is a way to interpret, and again, unless it's clear, it's not retroactive. There's a way to interpret that phrase of pending actions and interpret it in harmony with the notion of currently in existence that makes complete sense. You can have a pending action that deals with a policy that has not yet expired at the time of the enactment of the statute.
But it's still being applied retroactively to that policy because the policy was negotiated and signed before the statute.
I would agree with that. But, again, if they wanted this statute to apply to expired policies, I would say, why don't they just say that? They don't say policies in existence, and they don't say current policies. They use the specific phrase, currently in existence. Currently must mean something in that phrase.
I agree, and that strikes me as a separate question from, does it apply retroactively at all?
It could, yeah, I would agree that it could be a separate question, but at least if you have a policy that's currently in existence, which I would say means has not expired, and you have a pending case, aren't you at least giving the insurance company an opportunity to deal with the new change in the law? We have a policy in this case that expired years ago.
Absolutely, but I want to pin this down because it seems to me that this is the first point you made. I have yet to hear anything that convinces me that this thing doesn't apply retroactively to some degree.
Even if it does apply to some degree,
okay,
it doesn't apply to this case and it doesn't apply to this expired policy. Obviously, this court is not bound by the other panel at this court that decided last week that it is not retroactive, nor are you bound by the 10th Circuit's decision in that matter in the Greystone case. However, if we're going to argue about whether their interpretations are reasonable or not, I don't think there's a real argument there. Those interpretations maybe ones that we disagree with, but they're certainly reasonable. And if they're reasonable interpretations, the statute's not retroactive in that sense because it should have been unambiguously clear what this legislature intended to do. There actually is a comment in the record on this statute about the concept of retroactivity, although I don't think it was put in that phraseology. And it was asked to one of the drafters of the statute, which is how, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, how is this statute going to be applied to pending actions? And the answer was, well, it will serve as a guide, which is why we see some of that language in the statute, I think. The answer, if this were truly retroactive, I think should have been, well, we're changing the law and we're completely getting rid of general security, and now this is how all these cases will have to be decided, period. Why doesn't the statute just say that? And it doesn't. There is an ambiguity here, and the case law from this court and from the Supreme Court has been very clear. If there's an ambiguity, it is not retroactive.
Let me ask you the same question that I inartfully asked your colleague here. If it's true that the statute does apply retroactively to some degree and the presumption of prospectivity only has been overcome, and now we are just trying to figure out what policies currently in existence means, do we need particularly clear evidence to decide that, or are we just now construing, you know, statutory language as we would construe any other statutory language?
Well, no, I think you need particularly clear evidence. Again, if you're talking about to what degree, how far, whether it's how far back in time, to which policies that we're going to extend this retroactivity to. I would say that the obligation is on the legislature, knowing the body of case law that talks about unambiguous retroactivity has to be made very clear. It has to be
clear. This kind of, you're adopting this kind of gravity metaphor that I was using.
Well, so, yeah.
And maybe you can think of a better one. I'm trying to think of
I doubt I can think of a better one here at the podium. But if you're asking me, do we just construe it, which you are asking me, do we just construe it as we normally would with our normal tools of construction, or do we have to still look for that unambiguous statement? I say you have to find that unambiguous statement, that unambiguous evidence. Otherwise, I think I'm getting the impression that you're kind of slipping one through the legislature that's really in violation of the longstanding precedents that this stuff has to be perfectly clear. And it could have been made perfectly clear. In the very opening of the statute, they could have said that this will apply to all policies, whether expired or not. This applies to all occurrence-based policies, whether expired or not. That language is not in there. It easily could have been placed in there. And instead, as we think we've pointed out in our brief, there is conflicting authority or authority that we've cited to that shows that there have been decisions about what in existence means, and it doesn't mean expired policies, regardless of whether they're occurrence-based or not.
Do you agree with Mr. Sargent that the express reference legislative how this statute would apply to an expired occurrence policy?
I don't believe there's any express reference to that. I think the only detail in the history that I recollect as I stand here is that particular question that was asked to how this applies to pending actions. If my memory is failing me, then I'll concede that. I would also argue that we get to, even if we overcome the aspect of was intended to be retroactive, we run headlong into the prohibition on retrospective application of statutes. And what we run into here is what we've expressed in our brief. Under general security, there was no obligation to pay this claim. This is not an accident, it's not an occurrence, it's not property damage. And all of a sudden, now the statute is passed, and as was expressed to the lower court, appellants take the position that now the law has changed and now we have to pay. And if that is not a change in a contractual obligation that's prohibited by our Constitution, I don't know what is.
Now, counsel, would you agree with me that the whether the statute changes the common law and the extent to which it changes really depends on how we view what the common law is? In the absence of a definitive Supreme Court pronouncement on this subject, we are free to determine for ourselves what the common law was when the statute was passed. Is that correct?
I agree with that.
Okay, so I understand your argument that because the latest pronouncement or the then latest pronouncement was general security, it represented a big departure from the common law. What about Wong? What if we just decided that the common law was really more accurately stated in Wong?
Well, and I don't know that I agree that general security was a huge departure, but even if I can see...
No. If the statute was a departure from general security.
Understood, Your Honor. Yeah. That really is going to start getting into the substance now of the merits, and maybe that turns us away from the idea of retroactivity and unconstitutionality, maybe brings us into these other issues that Your Honors have set forth in the order, which is the substance and the merits of these three different authorities. And what I will say is, ultimately, although I believe general security is what applies here, and I think it makes sense in the language of our policy and as the expression of the logic behind that in general security, what I would argue is ultimately it doesn't really matter whether it's Montero Homes, it doesn't matter whether it's general security, and it doesn't matter whether it's Greystone. And here's why. Contrary to what appellant's counsel said a few moments ago, this problem with the pool shell was not caused by a subcontractor. There is no admissible evidence in the record for that. This was caused, and this was established in the affidavit that we submitted on summary judgment from the gentleman named Dale Sprague, the supervisor for Colorado Pool, the man who actually built the pool, from his own percipient knowledge, stated that what happened was the town of Castle Rock did an inspection of the rebar framework before the concrete was applied, and they said, you do not have enough room between what will be the outside wall and the dirt into which this bowl, concrete bowl, for lack of a better word, is to be placed. Fix that. Now, the way to fix that is you dig out the dirt and create more space. That's not what happened. The rebar was intentionally picked up and moved by Colorado Pool's employees. Again, all in the affidavit. Mr. Sprague said, I expected that that was going to be a problem. Why? This was to be a competition swimming pool built to exacting specifications in terms of its dimensions, its length, the walls, of course, being plumb. You can't have a competition when it doesn't fit with the rules. And if that lane is shorter than that lane, it had to be perfect. And that was not what was going to happen. Once the concrete was sprayed, and again, this is in the affidavit, they shoot it out of a gun. He got down in there and took his fingers and he scraped it along and felt that rebar underneath, just so you could feel your rib under your skin. And he knew right then, that's what I thought was going to happen. Now, there were solutions or proposed solutions to this problem, one of which is we just put another inch or 2 inches or 3 inches of concrete there and that solves our problem. Yeah, but it doesn't solve the problem that they didn't get the pool that they bargained for, which is a competition-sized swimming pool to the exact specifications. And that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a pool, as Your Honor indicated earlier, that didn't crack, didn't fail, it didn't blow up or leak, it didn't cause any consequential property damage. It simply wasn't built to the specifications that were required in the construction contract. It wasn't the thing that the property owner bargained for. And that, in our case law, I believe has been one of the quintessential things that we don't provide insurance coverage for. We don't make insurers the guarantors of the performance of the contractor in building whatever the thing is that they're building. And that's what Scottsdale is being made in this case to do, to guarantee or pay for the failure to build this thing according to a contract to the precise dimensions and specifications that were required.
Under your analysis, under those views of the facts, why then is this not covered? Is it because it's not an occurrence, or is it because it's excluded?
All of those.
Both.
It's not an occurrence. It's not an accident. The damage was expected. We know that. That's undisputed. And in fact, the owner of Colorado Pool testified in his deposition, and we made a point in our brief to point this out in a footnote, that we quoted his testimony at length in the summary judgment briefing. He admitted the rebar had been moved.
What about all the alleged consequential damages? We have to tear up the conduit. We're going to have to tear up the retaining wall when we take out this pool.
That is expected. And Your Honor may have alluded to that earlier. And I would actually, in support of that idea, I would go back to Greystone. And there's some interesting commentary in Greystone about this notion. And they say that, and I'm paraphrasing here to some extent, the obligation to repair defective work is neither unexpected nor unforeseen under the terms of a construction contract or CGL policy. And then they use an analogy, and I think they used it earlier, they talk about a window, and they say, a window that's correctly installed is not expected to leak. Let's flip that coin over. A window that's incorrectly installed is expected to leak. I think that makes sense. I think that's logical. In this case, we know that the supervisor, the man who was building the pool, before the concrete's ever sprayed, says, I expect this to be a problem. And then it is a problem. And the very thing that's being built, you might want to say the sine qua non of this pool, that it has to be this particular size, it's ruined now.
According to the factual record, was the pool replaced because it was out of size, which would seem to be a matter of inches based on what you say, or was it replaced because, corrosion of the rebar, given its proximity to the surface, was inevitable, and at that point then structural failure would occur?
Well, importantly, structural failure never occurred,
that's because they ripped it out.
Right, which is why I say there's no physical injury to any property here. But I think it was torn out because it was not built to specifications. It could have been fixed short of tearing it out, but that wasn't the pool that these people bargained for. And that's why this really is a situation where this is it would fall within our business risk exclusions. It is a situation where it's a breach of a contract, of a contractual term, not that the pool itself at that point in time is truly defective and that it's breaking apart. It's a situation where if you built somebody's cabinets in a kitchen and they said, I want them in maple, and they gave them to you in pine, I didn't get what I bargained for, and that's what happened here. These people didn't get the pool that they bargained for, and the contract between White Construction, which is the general contractor, and Colorado Pools required that Colorado Pools would have to fix any of these problems. In fact, that was admitted in the complaint that was filed in this case. So this really is a situation where there is no accident, there is no occurrence, and there is no property damage. Again, damage, as was noted here, is physical injury to property or loss of use of tangible property that's not physically injured. The fact that electrical conduit had to be replaced, that's not a loss of use. The pool wasn't even finished. None of this was being used at that point. So I don't understand how that's a loss of use, and there's certainly no physical injury to any part of this property. They note the problem right then after it happens and have to decide what to do about it. The contractual obligation says they have to fix it. The property owner said, we want you to tear it down and give us what we bargained for. In terms of the idea of repair and replacement costs, there actually are a number of authorities that discuss that is not part of, that is not property damage to have to repair or replace the work of others. They've referred to an article that was published by actually one of the people involved in filing an amicus brief in this case, and I'll refer you to a footnote in that case, I believe it's 42, where he's actually citing authority for the proposition that to have to remove other contractor's property, that's not property damage. That's just part of the process of having to repair. Notably, if you do tear out other property other work done by another contractor, how is that an accident? How is that something unexpected? It's really an intentional act to fix that type of thing. And I want to return quickly to the window analogy. If my window is improperly installed and it's going to leak, and I say you have to tear it out, doesn't the person who installed the window understand that you might affect the studs in the wall, you're going to pull the drywall out, which is put in by a different contractor, you're going to damage the paint, which is done by another contractor? Why is that replacement and repair of those things unexpected? And I submit it is expected.
Would you just cite briefly some authority that will stand for the proposition that we measure expected at that moment from the standpoint of here's the things we have to deal with?
Well, I would go back to Greystone, and when they make the comment that the obligation to repair defective work is neither expected nor unforeseen under the terms of a construction contract or CGL policy, I believe that is a statement that at that point in time that damage can be expected at that point in time.
I mean, doesn't Greystone
say that as concerns the contractor's non-defective work? And, you know, by definition, non-defective work of third parties, that is not foreseeable in the context of defining accident?
Well, what Greystone says is injuries flowing from an improper or faulty workmanship constitute an occurrence if resulting damage is to non-defective property caused without expectation or foresight. And that's where this case falls within, fails under the Greystone analysis, is what I mean to say. There was expectation. There was foresight here. The expectation was this pool is simply not going to be right because we moved that rebar, and it renders the whole thing useless for what they wanted it for. I want to move on briefly, since I only have a few seconds left, to note that we've raised other arguments about the exclusions in our policy, including J5 and J6 and M1 and M2. I believe that any one of those is a dispositive of these claims in this case, and regardless of the accident, occurrence, and property damage issue. That's only the first hurdle, and it can fail and does fail in any of these other hurdles. A comment was made about reasonability. I don't believe that under any of these facts you could say that the analysis of the insurance company was unreasonable in denying coverage because of the multiple bases for which there is no coverage or the coverage is excluded. And of course there is the statute of limitations issue, which we pointed out in our brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jim Dietrich, 7422. I represent the defendants J.A.B. Robbins and Hansen in this matter. The allegations, as the court knows, against J.A.B. and Hansen are that Hansen negligently misrepresented that there would be insurance coverage. Then it turned out that there wasn't, based upon the denial of coverage issued by Scottsdale in November of 2005. Plaintiffs allege that they relied upon a claimed misrepresentation by Hansen and incurred damages by engaging in repair work on the swimming pool, believing that there would be insurance coverage that would cover their costs incurred in that repair work. Now, the very interesting arguments involving insurance policy construction and statutory construction, for the most part, don't affect the claims against Hansen. We're kind of over here on a little bit of a side road on a lot of these issues here, but we are impacted to some degree. That is, to the extent that the court would determined that there was, in fact, insurance coverage, then I guess, of course, the negligent misrepresentation claim against Hansen would go away because
right.
he was right. So to that extent, Hansen is impacted by what is going on elsewhere. Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't it also impact it this way, the other way? Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought part of your argument was that the plaintiffs could not reasonably rely on Hansen's alleged misrepresentations or alleged representations about coverage if those representations were plainly contrary to the insurance policy.
Correct, Your Honor.
If we are struggling to determine what is the meaning of these policies, if the meaning of the policies is ambiguous, doesn't that affect your argument about no reasonable reliance?
If the court finds the insurance policy to be ambiguous, if the court finds that a reasonable reading of the insurance policy would lead one to conclude that there was coverage, then I agree with you on that particular issue.
Okay. Let me take Judge Russell's question a step further. Even if we don't conclude the policy is ambiguous, couldn't we also simultaneously conclude that the insured's reliance on the representation was reasonable simply because there was such a diversity of judicial opinion, at least outside Colorado, as to how the language would be interpreted?
Well, I think not, Your Honor, because first of all, we do have the Pete Satire case and the Branscombe case, which stand for the proposition that an insured is deemed to know the contents of his own policy. And in this particular case, the insured testified, Mr. Katowski testified, that he had a copy of the policy in his possession, that he had read it, and that he had retained an attorney to give him advice on insurance coverage. And that attorney was present during the conversation which took place with Mr. Hansen, where the alleged misrepresentation regarding coverage took place. So given the fact that an attorney is involved, Mr. Katowski has read the policy, the attorney has read the policy, the attorney is giving advice, I believe that places the situation squarely within the concept that the insured had equal access to information as Mr. Hansen did relative to the matter at issue, whether or not there would be coverage. He had equal access to information. He had the policy. He had legal advice.
But if that attorney had done the kind of research that the parties have done here or that is referenced in the Greystone case, wouldn't the attorney have told Mr. Katowski that there is no absolute bulletproof answer as to whether you're in the realm of accident or not?
Exactly.
And okay, if he told him that, wouldn't that make it more reasonable for him to rely on a representation of someone whom he believed to be an agent of the insurer?
Well, he knew the insurance company was analyzing coverage. Mr. Hansen was an agent retained by the insurance company to adjust the claim. Mr. Katowski knew that that Scottsdale Insurance Company was looking at coverage. Now, Mr. Hansen didn't say, Scottsdale has told me there will be coverage. And of course, there's a dispute as to exactly what he did say. But the claim is that he said, this would be covered, or this will be covered, or words to that effect. So, if Mr. Katowski, having the policy and having legal advice, is told, well, there's no bulletproof answer to that. The reasonable response by Mr. Katowski would be, well, we better find out what Scottsdale has to say then. They're the insurance company.
Doesn't that go to the question of GAB's alleged agency capacity, which we can't resolve in your favor based on at a summary judgment stage?
Well, of course, Pete Satire and the Branscombe case both stand for the proposition that an agent's representation that there would be coverage beyond what is actually provided in the policy cannot be used to expand coverage if the insurer has a copy of the policy, and in this case, the insurer did and had read it and had counsel. Your Honor, I actually think that since we're talking about bulletproof, I think the most bulletproof facts in this case that compel the dismissal of the claim, the lawsuit against GAB and Hansen, is the fact that there are absolutely no damages that can be shown that flowed from this alleged misrepresentation. Mr. Katowski, by his own admission, was obligated to remove and replace these pools and had been told by White Construction on September 16, 6 days before meeting with Hansen, where the alleged misrepresentation took place, had been told by White Construction 6 days before that meeting, either Colorado Pool replaces these pools or White Construction will do it and send you the bill.
And again, I'm not trying to nitpick testimony other than that it's a summary judgment record. Didn't Mr. Katowski also testify that in reliance on this alleged misrepresentation, he put some of his personal money into the repair as opposed to leaving it a corporate obligation and perhaps the corporation doesn't survive?
I don't remember that, but I don't know why that would matter. Because
his damages would be putting his personal money into the repair, whereas if it was only a corporate obligation, he wouldn't have had to do that.
He's the sole owner of the company. He chose to do what was necessary to keep the company complying with its contract with White.
Fair to say he chose to do what in a summary.
I just can't see that, Your Honor. But what I see is Mr. Katowski had no choice but either to replace the pool or not replace the pool and be handed by the bill by White Construction. So he moved forward replacing the pool. He claims in reliance on the representation that there was insurance coverage, but he also testified that by doing it himself, he was saving money. He could do it himself. His company could do itself cheaper than allowing White Construction to do it and then handing him the bill for their work. So he moved forward on his own, saved his company money until he ran out of money when the insurance company did not give him money. So then he ran out of money, he stopped it, he left the job. White Construction came in and finished the job, then handed him that bill through arbitration. They brought an arbitration action against Colorado Pool to recover their money for repairing and replacing the pools. So his two elements of damage were what he spent repairing and replacing before White Construction came in, which added up to about $100,000, and then what White Construction billed him and was awarded in arbitration, which was, I think, $130,000 or $140,000. The only evidence in the case is that by doing work himself, he saved money. If he had been told, hypothetically, on September 22, there's no coverage, and he'd said, well, I walk away from it, White Construction would have done it, and they would have sent him a bigger bill. And the only evidence in the case is it would have been a bigger bill than what he had.
Colorado Pool would have been liable for the whole thing.
They would have.
But Mr. Katowski, presumably, personally, would not have been liable for any of it.
Well, that may be true, but he testified at deposition when asked, what would you have done differently if you had been told there's no insurance coverage? He said, I don't know. He didn't say I wouldn't have put my personal money into it. So there's 3 seconds left, so I guess I'm finished. Thank you.
First, regarding the negligent misrepresentation case, the comments of Judge Webb and Judge Russell are exactly right. Patrick Katowski personally relied upon the representations of Mr. Hansen to put, I think it was something like $157,000 out of his own pocket into this. And second, the Pete Satire case, which they continue to cite and that the Supreme Court, that the trial court cited, in fact, the negligent misrepresentation case against the claim against the agent was actually upheld in that case. Several points on the Scottsdale matter. First, the affidavit of Dale Sprague about expected or intended, we never had an opportunity to respond to that. We requested additional time to deal with that, and the trial court said, I'm not relying on that anyway, denied summary judgment. Of course, we should have the opportunity to do that. Second, they say, well, the legislature could have said all policies, whether expired or not. Village Homes, of course, says an occurrence policy never expires. And finally, I'd just like to say, Team Corp and Cypress Amex Minerals regarding property damage.
Counsel, I'm going to keep you up for one more second if I can. Just one question. As you left, concluding the first part of your argument, you mentioned that Scottsdale had not put into the record the affidavit of the arbitration demand. And my question to you is, why doesn't that rain on your client as hard as theirs? Couldn't you have put that in? And explain to me why that isn't a failure that should be visited on your side.
Well, if we had won on summary judgment on that issue, then I think it would have been a problem. But they were the ones that were requesting summary judgment. They were the ones that were saying, as a matter of law, we had no duty to defend any claims by White or the Homeowners Association, and we had no duty to indemnify. And it was their obligation to show that. Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. We recognize the additional burden that the extra time we asked for imposed on counsel. We think that time was well spent. It's a difficult case. We will issue